The conversation continues. 203-333-9422. The Lisa Wexler Show is back on WICC 600.
And welcome back to the show. Joining us now, Congressman Jim Himes, who won with 60.5% of the vote, with a vote count of over 203,000 votes. And Jonathan Riddle of the Republican Party got 38% with just about 128,000 votes. A significant victory entering his seventh term. Congressman Jim Himes, welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. Congratulations.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you. It's great to be back with you.
So I'm just hearing from CBS that there'll be a recount in Georgia. But how are you feeling about the prospect of what looks likely Joe Biden being the president of the United States? Where does that leave you in Congress and committee ships and all kind of other things? Talk to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously, it's not just my party, but, you know, based on what we saw here in Connecticut, like most of the people in Connecticut, I will be very happy to say goodbye to the divisive and very angry and, quite frankly, corrupt leadership of Donald Trump. That's a big step forward for our country. In fact, what we've seen from the president in the last few days, which is wild allegations of fraud, even though the country's in the process of literally counting the votes of the American people, reminds us how important that is. But you asked about Congress as well. Here's where it gets interesting. We will have a Democratic House, and though we don't know this, it's probably more likely than not that there will be a Republican Senate. So we have divided government, and that means that we will not see major transformational change, and some people will be happy with that, some people will not. It means that we have an obligation, I have an obligation, to do what I've always tried to do, which is to work with the other side, and even if we can't agree on the really big things, at least agree on some things that make life better for the American people. So that's we're going to face a choice. You know, does divided government mean more warfare, or does it mean that we make a good faith effort to work with each other? And I think both sides need to ask themselves that question.
I'm going to go to the phones for you, Congressman Himes. We've got Kelly from Stamford who wants to ask you a question. Kelly, you're on the air with Congressman Jim Himes.
Hi, yes. I just have a quick question about the Paris Climate Agreement. One of the first things Biden wants to do when he's in office is join the agreement. And this is the deal that will make us pay more for gas and electric. And in Connecticut, we're already having issues with high rates from the utility companies, Eversource. Can you guarantee us in Connecticut that this will not happen since your party supports this deal? How is this good for Connecticut?
Thank you, Kelly.
Yeah, so you remember the Paris Climate Accord is not really a deal. It's the United States agreeing to reduce its carbon consumption by some targeted amount, and the rest of the world agrees to do that as well because the globe is at risk from climate change. We see this in our weather. We see this in all sorts of evidence around. And so it's an agreement to try to reduce the amount of carbon that we put into the atmosphere. I am not a believer, and I won't support things that dramatically raise the cost of energy. We need to, and I think we can, develop energy sources that are non-carbon intensive. Wind and solar are growing like weeds out there. I happen to support nuclear power, which irritates some people, but that's a non-carbon source of energy. And so I reject the notion that that doing what we need to do for our kids to stop climate change necessarily is going to lead to economic devastation. It has to happen over time, right? And we had a long conversation about fracking during the presidential election. There are thousands of jobs in Pennsylvania that depend on natural gas, and natural gas today is absolutely critical to producing energy and all sorts of other things. So the question to me is, do policymakers, rather than sort of getting into the kind of, you know, bickering that all too often happens, can we put together a path that gets us to a safer planet, a planet that we can leave to our kids with some pride, without devastating manufacturing, without raising people's energy prices? And I think we can do that.
You know, Congressman Himes, it's so interesting what you just said, because I just want to unpack a little bit of it. First of all, just noteworthy for us here in our area, many Westchester listeners to the show, that the fact that Governor Cuomo single-handedly decided to close the Indian Point nuclear power plant without having to, many viewed as a completely political decision, that is responsible for 25% of the energy produced in the New York City metropolitan area. And nobody has properly explained to the average consumer in Westchester County and elsewhere, even New York City, how that energy is going to be made up for the same money. I mean, it's just astonishing to me that he sort of got away with that by fiat, and that's it. And Indian Point is closing. They're done. And it hasn't been replaced by anything other than power that's coming from Canada. I just think that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and look, each individual plant has its own things. Westchester and New York City are some of the densest, most densely populated places on the planet. You know, if you were going to build a new nuclear power plant, you probably wouldn't do it just upriver from New York City. It's also an old plant, right? And we can build nuclear plants today, much smaller, much safer. So your larger point is right, which is, I forget the exact number, but we get something like a quarter of our power nationally from nuclear. Mm-hmm. And so the environmentalists, and remember, I've got like 100% score with the League of Conservation Voters, who say we need to do away with nuclear. But by the way, you also need to fix climate change. In the near term, those things are at odds with each other. And so the question to me is, can we solve a technological problem, which is safe nuclear? And I know the answer to that question is yes, because, you know, the United States Navy has been riding around on ships with nuclear reactors without any major accidents. And in fact, we've been producing energy for a very long time without accident. Three Mile Island, of course, was a scary moment. But, you know, compared to the number of people who die on oil rigs or coal mines or that sort of thing, we just need to be reasonable and practical about what we can achieve over what period of time. But the goals are the same. We gotta stop putting carbon into the atmosphere, and we gotta do it in a way that doesn't devastate middle class families through either the elimination of their jobs without alternatives or through the, you know, substantial increase in energy prices.
Well, and so one of the other things I just wanted to say is, because I know this intimately, because my husband is in the restructuring world, which is to say he's in the business of taking over businesses that are in trouble and trying to figure out if he can save them or they have to go away. And in the last few years, he has been given the task of doing that with coal-fired power plants. And it shocked me, Congressman Himes, but he told me recently, you know, just a few years ago, there were 2,000 to 3,000 coal-fired power plants in the country. There are only 200 to 300 left. They're almost gone. So when President Trump used to constantly promise people in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, as if you really wanted your kid to go shovel coal in a coal mine anyway, like that's what you really wanted aspirationally for your kid. I don't know anybody who ever wanted that for their kid. But when he used to shout from the rooftop that he was going to bring back coal and clean coal, the market forces have gone so far past that kind of rhetoric. They're already getting rid of coal. In real life, coal is not sustainable in the market. The market is already taking care of it. They don't want it. It's going away.
Yeah, you know, that's right, Lisa. But it also points us back to the Paris Climate Agreement question that we started this conversation with. You're absolutely right. There are actually fewer people working in American coal mines today or in the coal industry than there are working in the solar panel industry.
Absolutely.
That's not true in China. So China is building new coal-fired plants every week. And so the actions of the Chinese are going to put our children at risk. So what do we do about that? We lead, right? And if we withdraw from the Paris Agreement and then go to the Chinese and say, you guys can't build more coal plants, they're going to say, you know, go pound sand. You're not interested in a global problem. But if we are part of those international discussions, we have some standing to say to the Chinese, look, we're not building new plants, and you are, and you got to stop that. That's sort of another reason why we need to sort of, you know, be leading and present in these international forums, because this is not an American problem. This is a global problem.
No, it's a huge global problem. We're chatting with Congressman Jim Himes. So let me ask you, following up on that segue, one of the things that President Trump was praised for was a reset and looking at China more adversarially than other people have, including Joe Biden. One of the criticisms leveled at Joe Biden is that his attitude towards China was simply too cozy. and that President Trump's, even though it imposed tariffs that hurt some American businessmen, that Americans were willing to shoulder that economic cost. It was time to face China for what it is, totalitarian, ugly regime that it is, the greatest surveillance horror that any, you know, human society has ever known. And also they exploit world resources at a rate that's beyond comprehensible, including in Africa and everything else where they bribe everybody and they take everything from the elephants and the rhinos to the copper. So what do you think is going to be the attitude of a Biden presidency toward China? And you personally in Congress, what do you support in the way of an attitude toward China right now?
Yeah. And I mean, let me do something I don't do very often, which is I would actually give President Trump some praise for really calling out the Chinese in a very clear and explicit way. Mm-hmm. You know, and he did it around economic issues, and he was right to do it. You know, the Chinese have been stealing our intellectual property for way too long. They've been undertaking policies which have hollowed out our manufacturing for way too long. So I give him credit for being real clear about that. I'm not sure I agree with a lot of what he did. In other words, you know, tariffs. There are a lot of farmers who are hurting because of those tariffs. And, you know, one good way for us to, you know, stay in the game with China would be to actually follow through on, you know, the Asian and Pacific trade agreements. Instead, we walked away from those and basically said, China, this is your neighborhood. You deal. But you asked me how
but the farmers liked him, Jim. But the farmers liked him. They voted for him. He was able to find another pocket of federal money to give them big subsidies to make up for those tariffs. They didn't object. I mean, you can look at the map. They voted for him.
I hear you, Lisa. But when you say another pocket of federal money, you know whose money you're talking about, right?
Yours I know. It's our money. I know. It's so our money. I know.
Got used to buy farmers happiness. And look, you know, again, I'm not saying we shouldn't look out for our farmers. In fact, I am saying that Donald Trump was right to call out the Chinese. But, you know, you got to remember, here's what I think. It's hard, right? We got to call them out the way the president did on issues of, you know, on economic issues. We got to certainly call them out for everything that you named, including, by the way, putting, you know, Muslim minorities into concentration camps. Outrageous.
Oh, my God.
But we also need to remember that they are, you know, that the U.S.-China trade is kind of what makes both economies work. And we got to remember they hold a lot of our debt. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying it's true. So there's a couple of areas where, you know, we may not be happy partners, but we're going to need to be partners. And I think, you know, rather than saying, you know, sometimes it's easy in international affairs to say they're the bad guys, we're the good guys. And in a lot of areas, that's true. The old Soviet Union, that was pretty clear. China's a little bit more complicated, right? Because we are economic partners. We are the two biggest economies on the planet. And so, you know, the Biden administration is going to have to call them out where they need to be called out, but look to expand economic opportunities in both countries.
One of the reasons that people have been fearing the Democratic Party is this push towards the left. And I have all these phone calls every single day, Congressman Himes, that use words like socialist and Marxist in the same breath as Democrats. What do you think a Biden presidency is going to look like? And do you think it's going to be pulled by people that are perceived as radical, including AOC and her quote-unquote gang of four? What do you see for this presidency?
Well, what I see, and, you know, some of these folks that think that Joe Biden is a socialist, I mean, you're watching too much Fox News and you're not spending enough time looking at Joe Biden's record, right? You know, Joe Biden is a moderate. He's a pragmatist. In a Democratic primary, he didn't apologize for working with Republican senators, including, by the way, some Republican senators who were racist, like Strom Thurmond. He is a man of the center and of pragmatism. You know, he never endorsed Medicare for All. He never endorsed the Green New Deal. He said he wouldn't do that. But let me make a larger and more important point. I can't argue with people who, you know, look at Joe Biden and see a Bolshevik. I mean, that's so beyond who Joe Biden is that I just can't have that argument because it's just so outside of reality. But look, it looks like we're going to have a Republican Senate. And a Republican Senate, and even if, by the way, even if we have a tie or a very narrow Democratic majority, policy is not controlled by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It will, in that instance, be controlled by very conservative Democratic senators like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, right? So, look, I understand when you've mishandled a pandemic the way this administration has mishandled a pandemic, when there's millions of people out of work, you need to you know, fib about the other side. And anybody who's watched Joe Biden for 15 minutes knows that the man is not a Bolshevik. And anybody who thinks about the way our government looks, the risk is not that you're going to be screaming to the left. The risk is we may not get anything done. This gets back to where we started. If the two parties don't look at divided government and say we're going to work hard to find areas of common ground. And by the way, drop the Bolshevik socialism baloney, because that makes it very, very hard to find that common ground and that compromise. Yeah. And that's really the question. I don't think the risk is that the party's going too far left. Yeah, you know what? If you want to spend all your time watching AOC, you're going to see some things that irritate you. But AOC is not president, right? And she doesn't control the president, et cetera. So the question really is, are we going to be able to get anything done because people act decently and are willing to compromise with each other?
Congressman Himes, one more question. It's so nice to have you on the show, and congratulations. I was reading, I don't remember what it was, but it talked about, I think they called it gerontocracy, this idea, and they specifically focused on the House of Representatives, Steny Hoyer, and the ages, I'm talking about, of Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, her close circle of people that are into their 80s, their late 70s, and that these people just refuse to allow anybody younger, and frankly, that the Democratic Party House of Representatives is run by people who are too old right now. They're just too old. What do you think about that? Is there such a thing as being too old?
You know, it's not just a Democratic problem. Your facts are right there. The leadership is older. Same's true. Look, Mitch McConnell is not outrunning 10 miles a day, Donald Trump is not outrunning 1 mile a day.
Right. And neither is Joe Biden, frankly.
Right. So, no, it troubles me. You know, I'm of a different generation, right? I mean, I'm, you know, McConnell and Biden, those guys are, you know, my parents' age. And I'm, you know, I'm not outrunning 10 miles a day. So, you know, I'm not sure why it is. I think people get pretty used to power and don't want to give it up. I'm not sure why we haven't seen more push from my generation and younger. It's frustrating. I really think, and again, it's not necessarily just a pure Democratic problem. I really think, you know, 25-year-olds out there, they live in a completely different world than the world that 75 and 80-year-olds grew up in. Just a completely different world. And, you know, we miss an opportunity, I think, by not having more youthful figures in our leadership team to really speak to those folks.
What are you going to do in the way of committeeships? And I'm told that you have a distinction. That you had so much in your campaign war chest that you were able to give more away to help other people get elected than you even needed to spend on your own campaign. The supposition is, or the whatever, is that that is going to help you attain more leadership roles within Congress. So, Jim Himes, what do you want to do with this term? You're entering your seventh term. You've got seniority of your own now. You come from a very secure place in terms of reelection from an original district that was swing that you won from a Republican. What are you going to do with this confidence and stature? What do you want to chair in Congress?
Yeah. I mean, let me not beat around the bush. I would love to, you know, I would love to chair a committee or a subcommittee. But what's really important to me, Lisa, is two things. And I will use my seniority and whatever stature I may have to do this, is to deliver for the district. You know, we had an announcement last week that we brought in $80 million for the walk bridge in Norwalk. And I mentioned that specifically because the number one issue in the district, you know, apart from addressing the pandemic, which became the number one issue last February, is transportation infrastructure. So I just, I want to go to town to get the insane problems that we have in southwestern Connecticut with our railways, with our infrastructure generally addressed. The other thing I want to do is I just want to feel useful. It's pretty easy to, if you don't stay intentional in a body of 435 people, to get into a rut. And, you know, I'm not, as I pointed out before, getting any younger. So, you know, I let me give you, apart from what I need to do in this district, which is about transportation infrastructure, Lisa, we have a huge, I've alluded to this, we have a huge thing we need to do in this country, which is we need to start stitching our civic fabric back together, right? We are screaming at each other. We're at each other's throats. Families are divided. Friends aren't talking to each other. What the hell? How did this happen? I mean, I have my theories, but I'm going to keep them to myself. We have a lot of work to do. And when I say we, I mean you and me, right? Because we both have platforms. To just getting our conversation more constructive and less tribal and less angry.
Yep. That's what we do here every day on our show. I'm really proud of our audience. We don't do shouting, and we do a lot of different opinions. We do a lot of different opinions. And I think that the venting of opinions in a respectful, safe space is very valuable for the community. Very.
Yeah. I mean, look, nothing makes me more unhappy than to hear one side or the other. This is why I sort of object. You know, calling somebody a socialist or a Bolshevik, that's not as bad as calling somebody evil or criminal or corrupt.
Right.
And you know what? I'm not even going to point a finger at the Republicans here. The president, the current president, seems to love that. But my side does it, too. And it's got to stop. It's got to stop. What we're talking about is the future policy of the United States of America. And nobody has a lock or a monopoly on good ideas. And so we just got to change the nature of that dialogue for our own good.
Congressman Jim Heim, so nice to chat with you. Congratulations to you. Best to your family. Don't be a stranger on our show. Remember, I was the first person to put you on the radio and you were just a candidate. You know that I had that distinction. You came
That's
into my studio.
You
were just
Norwalk.
A kid. I was just a kid, too. We were both just kids. It was fun, though. And I, you know, I've watched you grow and mature, as we all have, into this role. And I think you're going to keep at it and really, really be able to generate some leadership. So congratulations. Good luck. Stay well. Best to your family. And thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks very much, Lisa. Look forward to coming back.
It's a pleasure for me. We'll be right back with more of the Lisa Wexler Show. Wayne Winston up next. We'll talk about race and its dynamic through this process, and we'll continue to take your calls as well at 203-333-9422.